From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, with little fanfare and no press presence, President Trump signed a new executive order that blocks visas for people living in six Muslim-majority nations and temporarily halts the U.S. refugee program. The new order was issued to address some of the legal challenges to his original travel ban. But critics say it's still fundamentally the same, a de facto Muslim ban. This hour on point in our 100-day spotlight, President Trump's travel ban 2.0. You can join us on air or online. Do you support the travel ban? Oppose it? On what grounds? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first this hour from Washington is Margaret Brennan, foreign affairs and White House correspondent for CBS News. Margaret Brennan, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Great to be with you.
So this executive order has a much narrower focus than the first one did, significant concessions. Walk us through it, Margaret. What's different this time?
Well, this new executive order is essentially a tacit acknowledgement that the first version had too many legal and political flaws in it, and that's putting aside simply the rollout problems there. The language of this is a bit narrower. You still see 120 of refugees, but this time Syrians are taken off the blacklist. No indefinite ban on Syrians specifically. There's also still a 90-day freeze on visas on visitors from six countries instead of seven. Iraq is now off that list following significant outcry not only from our allies in Baghdad who are fighting alongside the U.S. against ISIS, but also from the Secretary of Defense and the Secretaries of State who said this actually hurts our campaign and our national security fight against ISIS. You also see the language removed that prioritized religious minorities, and that was really politically loaded and lent a lot of fodder for fights in the courts, saying that this was a Muslim ban because it prioritized religious minorities in majority Muslim countries. In other words, Christians, as the president had phrased it in an interview back when he rolled out the first version of this. Mm-hmm. So it's a little less thorny, but it still sticks to the broad strokes of what the president first went through here. He also continues to keep the cap on refugees at 50,000 over the course of the year, which is really sort of slashing in half the projections that the Obama administration had laid out, saying that's how many they want, 100,000 refugees. So this significantly cuts back on that, too.
It also provides waivers for business travelers, dual citizens, military translators, foreign nationals with a history of work and study in the United States, and those with existing visas still can come to the U.S., correct?
That's right. These were all of some of the loopholes, the problems, the issues that were encountered when the first travel ban was implemented. You saw that with crowds and detentions at airports, and you heard that from diplomats and some at the Pentagon who said this was actually hurting some of their communication with partners like Iraqis that were getting training on how to fly F-16s in Arizona when they were banned in this blanket version of the first EO.
You mentioned Iraq is now off the list. Here during yesterday's news conference announcing this new executive order, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson explaining why Iraq was removed from the list of seven countries where the restrictions applied.
This intense review over the past month identified multiple security measures that the State Department and the government of Iraq will be implementing to achieve our shared objective of preventing those with criminal or terroristic intent from reaching the United States.
And here's Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly at that same press conference talking about the new guidelines, saying they will not affect people who had previously been issued visas.
It is important to note that nothing in this executive order affects existing lawful permanent residents or persons with current authorization to enter our homeland. Unregulated, unvetted travel is not a universal privilege, especially when national security is at stake.
So, Margaret Brennan, the last travel ban caused a lot of chaos. Travelers were detained at U.S. airports, barred from boarding flights overseas. What is the plan for implementation this time?
Well, in order to try to avoid that confusion, and frankly, there was a lot among diplomats at embassies around the world and the advice they were giving to people who had visas in hand, sometimes being told, don't get on the plane because you won't be allowed in, when in fact, if they were green card holders or, you know, did fit in these parameters, they would have been. So there was a very messy rollout. I think most agencies would agree with that. And this time, that's what you heard Secretary Kelly saying there they were going to avoid, in part because they're rolling this out in mid-March. In other words, there's advanced warning this time. And that is something that the White House has said actually they think is a bad thing. The claim in the past with the first version of this is that the travel ban was to cut off an immediate, imminent threat. And this time you're hearing the department heads from this, you know, from state, from Homeland Security, and from the Pentagon say we can roll this out in advance of this, give fair warning so that it can be implemented fairly. And what that is a tacit acknowledgement there is that, by the way, there already are screening and vetting procedures in place, which is something that the White House had previously said just wasn't enough to snuff and that we were all at risk of if they didn't immediately halt travel. So there are some political issues here in terms of undermining the premise that President Trump had laid out in the past.
Of course, the last executive order was put on hold by federal courts. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions yesterday saying that the new order is well within President Trump's legal authority.
The Department of Justice believes that this executive order, just as the first executive order, is a lawful and proper exercise of presidential authority. This Department of Justice will defend and enforce lawful orders of the president consistent with the core principles of our Constitution.
Margaret Brennan, how concerned is the White House that this order will face legal challenges, certainly, and do they think they will prevail?
Well, the White House has never admitted that there was any room for a possible defeat in the courts, even though they went back to the drawing board on this executive order in part because they wanted to stop having to fight this on court-by-court basis. But what we know now is that with this new version, the Trump administration is trying to deliver on a campaign promise while avoiding some of the self-inflicted wounds that they brought upon themselves with the first one. What is still an issue here and that you didn't hear addressed by any of the department heads or by the attorney general yesterday is the fact that none of the recent terror attacks or mass shootings on American soil were perpetrated by people from the nations listed in this ban. So that a broader issue of national security and overhauling of this, it isn't answered with this executive order. And so while this solves a political issue and possibly a legal one for the administration, it isn't the end of the sentence. And it also doesn't really put to bed some of those concerns that this is a de facto backdoor Muslim ban by picking these six countries. The White House said yesterday, oh, by the way, we might add more. So any of the recent terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, a lot of national security analysts would say, you really need to, if you want to stop them, look at radicalization in the United States by Americans or naturalized Americans, not people necessarily coming in on a day-to-day basis.
Margaret Brennan, foreign affairs and White House correspondent for CBS News. Always great to have you. Thanks, Margaret.
Thanks.
Joining me now from Washington via Skype, Yoki Driesen, deputy managing editor and foreign editor at Vox. Yoki, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thanks. Good to be with you.
So your reaction to the Trump travel ban 2.0?
I think that it is going to be marginally better and marginally less controversial than the original one. But I do think it's worth stepping back and setting aside the process for a second and just focus still on the bigger picture of what's happening here, which is a U.S. president for the first time in the lifetime of most voters, if not the vast bulk of voters, saying that a country that has welcomed refugees and immigrants since its founding would no longer do so. And what you're hearing around the world is less anger than the first time, in part because this one is mildly softer, in part because this one was expected, whereas the other one was a total shock. But what you're hearing is sadness. You're hearing leaders from the UN to individual countries. It's less fury and more just resignation that they knew it was going to come, and profound sadness now that it has come.
So beyond the sadness, what are the actual foreign policy implications at play with this new action?
So So most of the countries that are on this list are countries that are not terribly, not to be callous here, but are not terribly important to the U.S. in terms of its national security. These are countries, for the most part, where the U.S. has either poor relations or minimal relations or no relations. What the big question is, and it's hard to answer speculating right now going forward, but the very big question is, what does this do to the way the Muslim world, and particularly the Arab world, sees Donald Trump? And one path, one possible choice is they will look at this and say, well, the major Arab powers were not included. So Saudi Arabia in particular, which we know has funded terrorism around the world, including involvement in the 9/11 attacks, was not included. So there will be people in the Arab world who say, okay, they recognize the importance of alliances. But there will be many others who, even though, as Margaret said, this no longer specifically benefits Christians, will still say this is fundamentally an anti-Muslim ban. And when you look at foreign press, especially in the Middle East, that's how it's described universally. It's a ban on Muslims. No other defense, no other justification that the White House uses is even cited. It's just flatly referred to as a Muslim ban.
So you mentioned alliances. I'm curious what you're hearing from counterterrorism officials about how this new travel ban might impact their work, both in the United States and abroad.
The interesting thing about this is I haven't talked to a single current or former counterterrorism official who thinks that this is a good idea. I'm not saying based on that there are none who do, but none who I've spoken to support this for two reasons. One, they point out that the terror attacks that have taken place in the U.S., the ones that Donald Trump often mentions on the campaign trail, were not carried out by anyone from these countries. They were carried out by native-born Americans who radicalized while already here. So the idea that this would keep out potential terrorists doesn't hold water to them. Doesn't hold up to them. But the other one comes back again to the perception issue. If the U.S., since President George W. Bush, has been trying with success and some failure to persuade Muslim countries, Arab countries, who we desperately need to fight ISIS, desperately need to still fight Al-Qaeda, that this is not a war on Islam, that the U.S. is not hostile to Islam, this kind of travel ban makes all of that work much, much harder. So it not only doesn't necessarily benefit counter-terror efforts, it potentially sets them back considerably.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the new travel ban signed yesterday by President Trump, and you can join the conversation. What are the foreign policy implications of the new ban? What does the world think of the United States now? Here's a February 22nd interview with Fox News where White House advisor Stephen Miller said that the new executive order on immigration will accomplish much of what the initial January order did, but with a few changes.
Fundamentally, you're still going to have the same basic policy outcome for the country, but you're going to be responsive to a lot of very technical issues that were brought up by the court, and those will be addressed. But in terms of protecting the country, those basic policies are still going to be in effect.
Yoki Driesen is with me this hour from Washington, foreign editor at Vox. And joining me now, also from Washington, is James Woolsey, former CIA director under President Clinton. He served as an advisor to President Trump during the campaign and for part of the Trump transition. James Woolsey, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So what do you see in this new, more narrowly focused travel ban?
Well, I think it's very close to what they should have done in the first place. They caused themselves a great deal of trouble by issuing this thing without thinking through it and not being clear how they were going to deal with permanent resident aliens, green card holders, having a number of people who had fought beside us in Iraq get caught up in being excluded and on and on. It was just a mess. And I think that they've rethought it, as they should have done before they put it out in the first place, and have now a reasonably coherent approach. They're down to six countries, not going with Iraq, which is, I think, correct. And these are terror-sponsoring countries designated. Iran is the worst, but the others have very definite terrorist sponsoring backgrounds of one kind or another. And I think may not be perfect. This is a very blunt instrument excluding people from a country, but it's better than what they were talking about at first, which was excluding people of a particular religion.
Here's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson yesterday saying that the goal of this order, the one of them, is to prevent terrorists from arriving in the United States and to keep Americans safe.
While no system can be made completely infallible, the American people can have high confidence. We are identifying ways to improve the vetting process and thus keep terrorists from entering our country. To our allies and partners around the world, please understand this order is part of our ongoing efforts to eliminate vulnerabilities that radical Islamist terrorists can and will exploit for destructive ends.
So, James Woolsey, he mentions vetting there, the Secretary of State. Many say that we already have a tough, thorough vetting system in place for refugees. What do you think needs to change about our current vetting system? And does this executive order go too far on that? To your mind, maybe not far enough? What do you say?
I think part of the problem is in this part of the world, let's say you're wandering around the souk in Damascus, you can probably buy an American passport that's been forged for $100, maybe much less. So this is a serious problem trying to get this all sorted out. And I think what the administration has now done is finally sort of measured twice to cut once. They finally have understood that they need to do the work and understand what they're trying to accomplish and how they're trying to do it before they start making announcements rather than after.
So what's your response to those who say, Margaret Brennan mentioned this at the top, that this order solves a political and a legal problem for the White House, probably, but that the ban focuses on countries that are rarely linked to attacks on the United States? Left off the list are, listener John says here, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt, perhaps Turkey, you know, and other predominantly Christian countries that even the State Department says are terrorist safe havens like Colombia, Philippines, Venezuela. I mean, what about all those countries? Should they be on the list?
Well, I don't think you can do all of this at once. This is now a reasonable list. I don't think it was reasonable before when it included Iraq, because it caught up a number of people who had bravely been our interpreters there, our translators, had fought beside the United States. And that was just a terrible decision to stumble on those and be excluding them. But generally speaking, these are countries that are on the terrorist list, and I think they all are, as a matter of fact. And that creates a very different situation than from a country like, say, Bolivia or whatever. I think one shouldn't overdo this, This is a reasonable approach, finally, after they stumbled badly.
So, Yoki Driessen, jump in here. With this ban, based on what we've just been talking about here, have we made it harder for foreign terrorists to attack us?
No, and I have to, with respect, take issue with the previous comment about buying a passport in a shuk. I've spent close to 5 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, including in shuks all over the Arab world. I have never seen a passport for sale that looks even remotely valid or usable. And the idea that this has become sort of a talking point among supporters of the ban, the idea that people are not vetted is just simply nonsensical. Most refugees spend, especially if they're coming from a place like Syria, spend between 18 months and 2 years. That had been the criticism leveled against this program by most world leaders before this ban, which is, hey, United States, why are you spending 2 years looking at people when other countries are expecting them in sooner? So this notion has become a very popular talking point, but this notion that we don't know who's being allowed in, this notion that they've come in and carried out terror attacks at their sleeper cells, there's just no evidence that's true. Yesterday, Jeff Sessions put out a number that there were 300 people, he said, from these countries that were under investigation. He didn't say for what. He didn't say over what time period. He didn't say what level of investigation. And so this number put out in the abstract sounds very scary, but we don't have any reason to know how serious it is. We don't have any sense of what it might entail. And you get this kind of self-fulfilling conservative talking point meme. There's no question that refugees and immigrants should be vetted. But the idea that they're not vetted, the idea that you could just buy a passport somewhere, go to the United States and wander in without a biometric chip that's included in most passports, it's not true.
Yoki Driessen, James Woolsey, hold on for a moment. Let me get some calls in here. Julie is in Austin, Texas. Hi, Julie. Welcome to On Point. You're on the air.
Hi, Jay.
Hi.
I'm calling in support of the travel ban.
Okay.
From my perspective, it's just like hitting a pause, a reset button, 420 days. I'm just not understanding why everybody's in an uproar. Got everybody anxious, and I have never seen this level of anxiety over just a pause button.
Julie, thank you for the call. Let's hear another point from Don in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are we doing? Well, I totally 100% disagree with what the caller, I believe she just was chatting from Florida. I think this whole policy is egregious. It's more fear-mongering from the right. That's all these people seem to do. If you're so worried about people dying, why aren't we attacking cancer and heart disease? They kill way more people in this country than an immigrant does. Immigrants come over here. They want to live the American dream. They work hard, and really they do very well. And that's really what I think the problem is. I think people are jealous of the immigrants. They don't like to see people come over here and do well.
Don, thank you. So those are two very different perspectives. James Woolsey, jump back in here. The president says he wants Muslim nations to help in the fight against terrorism. But is the administration setting a tone with this that treats individual Muslims in Muslim countries as more of a threat than really a partner in this fight? What do you say?
Well, take Egypt as an example. Egypt is not on the list. Egypt is now gotten temporarily, at least, by its Muslim Brotherhood period. So the Muslim Brotherhood organization doesn't have the power in Egypt that it did for a couple of years. I think that we should, and basically in this situation, are looking on Egypt as a colleague to work together with to avoid terrorist attacks. And one of those is to work on immigration issues, but not to exclude Egyptians as part of this program. So I think, this is a matter of judgment. There are good fake passports and bad fake passports. There are moderates and there are hardliners, and one is threading one's way through a complex set of circumstances and the government now is doing the best it can. It was very, very clumsy when it started out.
Yoki Driesen, what are the optics here at a time when we need partnership and cooperation, especially in the Muslim world?
The optics are that the U.S., out of fear and ignorance, is banning people of an entire faith without valid national security reasons. I mean, that's the optics, and that's the way that this is being portrayed almost universally in both the Arab and Israeli press. The Israeli press, not necessarily always sympathetic to the cause of Muslims or of Arab immigrants, but that's the coverage there too. It is worth just pointing out one brief number. You think about the 9/11 attacks. I mean, that's the attack that changed American history, that is still kind of the touchstone for issues like this. The people who carried out the attack, none of them, none of the countries that from which they came, are on this list. 19 total, 15 were Saudi Arabian. Saudi Arabia is not on the list. The rest of the UAE, not on the list. Egypt, not on the list. And so if we're looking, actually trying to think, okay, what countries pose a terror threat to the U.S. based on demonstrable attacks against the U.S.? Those countries are not on this list.
James Woolsey, what about that?
Well, because some people from a country have carried out an attack, doesn't, as in 9/11. Doesn't mean that we should forswear working now, for example, with the Saudi government. The Saudi government is under siege from Iran, which is the number one terrorist country in the world by everybody's measure. And so if we want to help pull together a coalition with the Saudis and the Jordanians and others to deal with this situation, we can't ignore working, say, with Saudi Arabia. We've got to do it. And that doesn't mean that we've made some terrible mistake. We didn't make a terrible mistake in World War II when we allied even with Joseph Stalin. We had to defeat Hitler. And sometimes you have to do that in circumstances.
But James Woolsey, is there any concern at all that this alienates the Muslim world, that it's seen as a Muslim ban, and that alienates those people that we need to work with in the process?
Well, I think the administration has done now as well as it can to deal with the problem with a degree of alienation that's going to occur. I think one can't avoid having people get upset with one in this modern age in the Middle East. There are so many factions headed at one another. that everybody's going to be, almost everybody's going to be mad at almost anything one does. And I don't think that we can ignore people coming in from Somalia and Sudan and Yemen, where there are major terrorist operations taking place, and just kind of pass it by because it doesn't look good. I mean, we got to sort of man up and do what we have to do.
Back to the phones. Many, many callers here. Let's go to Marvin in Franklin, Tennessee. Hi, Marvin. You're on the air. Welcome.
I am. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I am really tired of this administration grandstanding, and I think this is another example of it, because I don't know what's going to happen after 120 days. All we're doing is spreading bad will with the other Muslim countries. There are a lot of Muslims in this country that are just waiting to do something, not a lot, but probably a few Muslims, that probably think, you know, I'm sick of being treated like a fifth-class citizen. And I'm curious to see, what are they going to do after 120 days? That's all the other points that I had have already been addressed. So really, that's
Marvin, thank you.
On.
I'll turn your question to Yoki Driesen. What does happen in 120 days, Yoki?
Well, so they've been kind of unclear about that, I think, deliberately. They've hinted that it may be extended. They've hinted, as you mentioned at the outset, that more countries may be added to this list. I suspect that they will watch carefully what happens over these next 120 days in terms of both legal challenges, political challenges, implementation challenges, optics. I mean, if you have other scenes of people at airports being turned away by confused immigration employees with the U.S. government, I suspect they're going to watch that very closely to see, frankly, is there much of a reaction from the Arab world, or does this pass with much less controversy? And I think that if it passes without much controversy, if they feel like it's been a success, this will be extended.
Dave in Springfield, Ohio. Hi, Dave. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
First, I have a comment and then a question.
Okay.
My comment is that it's kind of puzzling and a little bit disconcerting why President Trump lifted the ban on Iraq when we're in an ongoing battle over there. Mosul is still under heavy siege. It's a main route, probably the main route right into Syria.
Yeah.
And why? I mean, people that are over there now battling against the allies of us, they could come over here and do ill will.
We still have a real fight in Iraq. That's right. I'm going to hurry you along for time's sake, Dave. What's your question?
And my question is, you know, is there maybe some kind of military implication here that President Trump wants to use Iraq as a base of operations to fight perhaps Syria, Iraq, and maybe even Iran? I mean, we're going to get sandwiched in between those two countries.
Dave, thank you very much for the call. James Woolsey, you can speak to that, but talk to us in the last 45 seconds here before I know you have to go, what you see ahead, not only with Iraq now off the list, but, you know, all of these six countries still on the list. Where do you hope this takes us in the next six months, 1 year?
It doesn't mean some Iraqis who don't vet well can't be excluded, but the automaticity of moving against keeping out Iraqis when there are quite a few Iraqis who worked with us and fought beside us, I think was what caused problems for a lot of people, including me, with this original statement that the White House came out with. This current situation is far from ideal. But I don't think you want to leave Yemen and Sudan and Somalia and Iran being able to send people into the United States for a while. We want to stop, take stock, see how things go, and then maybe we can make some changes. Maybe it'll be the case that, you know, Libya will calm down and things will look a lot better there than it is now. I don't know, but
an ongoing scenario. James Woolsey, CIA director under President Clinton and advisor to President Trump during the campaign and for part of his transition. I appreciate your time, Mr. Woolsey. Thank you so much. Yoki Driesen, stick with us. We're discussing President Trump's new travel ban, and you can join the conversation, listeners. What's the ban stand for to you? Is it hurting relations with Muslim and the Arab world? I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYpod. And thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the new travel ban, and you can join the conversation. Muslim Americans, are you afraid to travel abroad now? On the floor of the U.S. Senate yesterday, New York Democrat and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the revised executive order is still a travel and refugee ban that makes the country less safe.
It still attempts to turn innocent immigrants and refugees into scapegoats and still doesn't do the things that would actually make us safer, like going after lone wolves and closing the loopholes in the visa waiver program. The new executive order is still mean-spirited, misguided, and in my judgment, goes against what America's all about in being a country that accepts and cherishes immigrants, not disdains them.
Joining me now from Cincinnati, Ohio, Rula Alush. She's chairwoman for the National Board of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Rula, so great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
So there you hear Senator Chuck Schumer saying this new executive order is mean-spirited, misguided. He said it's a watered-down version of the last one, which is un-American. How do you see this?
Yeah, I mean, this is still a ban on Muslims. President Trump, then candidate Trump, in December of 2015, declared that he had an intent of implementing a ban on Muslims. And over a dozen times after that, in December of 2015, that statement and that intent was reiterated. And this watered down ban is still a Muslim ban on individuals from six Muslim majority countries.
So do you see this these restrictions as discriminatory? Will you go that far?
Yes, I think that, I mean, there's a partial victory in this new ban for those who were challenging legally and on constitutional bases the first ban, certainly in some of the changes that have been made, but the ability for the administration to still have discriminatory intent in their implementation of the new executive order is cause for concern.
The revised directive removes language that appeared to give priority to Christian refugees applying for visas from predominantly Muslim countries. Is that something that was important to you?
It was important, but we still know the intent behind this ban based on the statements of the president and also his advisor, Stephen Miller, recently kind of promising that the watered-down Muslim ban would just be a retooled document that would achieve the same unconstitutional policy that they talked about during the campaign, and really that pledge of banning Muslims from entering the U.S.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations filed a federal lawsuit challenging President Trump's first immigration ban. Do you plan to file another court challenge now?
We're certainly looking at what legal strategies we need, and we will continue to push back against any a discriminatory policy by this current administration, whether it be this current ban or any future policies that they've promised may be coming down the loophole.
How do you think this executive order will impact your community? I'm speaking of the Muslim community in the United States.
I mean, this is still a community that has now a president that has said and repeated multiple times Islamophobic statements and statements that are very concerning to not only Muslims, but people of different minority backgrounds and different groups. There's a rise in anti-Semitism, a rise in Islamophobia, and hate crimes against people in this country. And this ban, while there are changes and while we may call it a watered-down version, it still reflects that same discriminatory intent against Muslims and against Islam. And members of our community will continue to feel alienated and feel a target on our backs.
Let's get Victoria in here from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Victoria. I'm glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call, Jane.
Yes.
I'm calling because I work with a local, several local agencies that work with refugee resettlement and migrant workers. And this ban, and there was a previous caller who had said, you know, what is 90 days, 120 days? It's just a pause. Those are real lives, lives that I see on a daily basis, people who are impacted, who are fearful, and who don't completely understand why it is that their young child, who maybe is 11 years old, is still not coming over, why their grandmother at age 91 is going to die in a refugee camp instead of making her way to a place that's safe and comfortable. And it's completely un-American. And so I would suggest to anybody wondering, what is the 90 days, what is the 100 days, to please come and volunteer with a resettlement agency. We have a robust program here in Omaha. We have one of the largest populations of Somalis outside of Somalia. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, we've not seen increased criminal activity. We've not seen any of these problems that people are talking about. It is a lot of fear-mongering, and there's not a lot of grains of truth to what they're telling you.
Victoria, I appreciate your call. Arul, I wanted you to jump back in here because Victoria brings up an important point. Have you been in contact with refugees or others who've been affected by this, who've been waiting to come to the United States, and where do they stand now?
Yes, certainly. You know, CARE and our national headquarters and chapters across the country have been dealing with many, many calls from community members that have family members and are concerned by the first ban and now by the modified version that was signed and put into place yesterday. And just following up on Victoria's comments, I mean, you know, the president claims that this is a ban that's needed based on an imminent threat, although there's no factual basis for that statement. And the fact that they take weeks to reissue this new watered-down version of the ban, have now a rollout period included within it, it just goes to show that this really has a discriminatory intent based on his own comments that were made starting back in December of 2015, and don't address any security concerns because those aren't there. We have a process that vets people, particularly refugees coming from Syria or other places, undergo extreme vetting before they are able to enter this country, and that's what's in place to keep our country safe.
Mm-hmm. Yoki Driesen, jump back in here. Under President Obama, the United States was scheduled to take in about 110 refugees this year. This new Trump executive order, cuts that to about 50,000. Talk about the impact of that, practically speaking.
Yeah, the U.S. has been sort of the outlier among developed countries in terms of how many refugees it's taken in. You know, by comparison, Germany, which is about a fifth the size of the United States, has taken in close to a million Syrian refugees, I should say, just in the past 18 months or so. Now, that, to be fair, has caused both active criminality and huge political problems for Angela Merkel, for the German chancellor. It is not popular there any more than the idea of it is popular here. But it's worth noting, we're a country of 350 or 360 million people. These are refugees who go through one year, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months of vetting to come to the United States. And even if all of that had happened, we would still be accepting a tenth of what Germany has taken, a tenth of what Jordan has taken, a 15th of what Turkey has taken. So the idea that we just don't have the capacity as a country to adequately vet and make sure we know who is coming, or for that matter, practically absorb 110,000 people into a country our size, just doesn't hold water to me.
But to Yoki, those who say, who are listening right now, it's not our responsibility, you know, and it takes just one. You say most have been vetted for many months, even years at a time. Well, you know, there's some who sneak through the cracks. What's your response?
Sure. I mean, the broader argument about should the United States be a country that accepts refugees, that's a fair argument to have. I mean, we have been historically. There have been moments where we didn't. You know, the U.S. banned Chinese immigrants for a long time in the early 1900s. It's banned Japanese immigrants. It's banned Jewish immigrants in the run-up to the Holocaust. So the moments of the U.S. saying, no, we will not accept people in, that's not new, and that is a fair debate. But I think the question is, is this being done smartly? Is it being done legally? Is it being done on the basis of religion? And then fundamentally, set aside whether we have an obligation to accept people from other countries. I don't think anyone would say we have an obligation to do it. But look at it more as ephemeral, as a values issue, and then slightly less ephemeral as a national security issue. Is our national security helped by saying to a big chunk of the world, you are not welcome? Whether that is correct or incorrect, that's how it's interpreted. Does that help us or not?
Let's go to Samer in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Samer. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Jane, there has been a lot of talk in the news about the effect of the executive order on the refugees and the plight of refugees. Mm-hmm. And that's a noble point to talk about. But there isn't a lot of talk about immigrants. I have been in the United States for 35 years. I originally came from Syria. And under United States law, I was able to apply for immigration visa for my brother. I started the process back in 2003. It took 14 years now, 2017, mm-hmm. until to get my brother's approval to go to the embassy and get his visa. As a matter of fact, I received a notification last week that an interview has been set for him at the American Embassy in Jordan.
After 14 years, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And now this executive order has changed everything. It's a punishment for people who played by the rule, who patiently waited 14 years to come here legally, and all of a sudden all their hopes and dreams have been smashed in a second, in a sign of a pen.
Samer, thank you very much for your story. Good luck to you. Let's get another call in here, Tony in Detroit. Hi, Tony, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Yes, I would just like 3 points, kind of, sort of. So first of all, if your guests, I think, are actually hypocrites, because President Clinton and President Obama also said they were going to limit or put bans on travel from certain countries in either during their tenure as presidents or their campaigns. That's one point. Second point is the immigrants coming in. I don't see what benefit are we receiving from these immigrants coming in. They can't speak our language. They can't have no skills, no job skills. We're going to support them for how many years? And then in Detroit, if you go to Dearborn, Michigan, I really don't think they're assimilating to our culture.
All right, Tony, thank you very much. Yoki Driesen, speak to Tony's point about being hypocritical. Democratic presidents, Clinton, Obama, among others, have said the same thing about who they'd like to keep out of this country.
I mean, I don't think that that's quite right. They haven't said the same thing, in part because neither of them campaigned by explicitly and implicitly saying Muslims are a threat, we are going to keep Muslims out. That was not part of their campaign rhetoric. That was not part of things that aides to them have said. That's not something that they themselves have either implicitly or explicitly said. I just don't think that you can draw the comparison. I think you can draw a comparison and say that President Obama in particular had at various times talked about trying to toughen and lengthen the vetting process for Syrian refugees. That's the reason why the number he ended up in, as you mentioned before, was 110,000, which again is a very small number. It is because of some of the fears that the caller mentioned. It's some of the fears that James Woolsey alluded to. But the rhetoric is, I think, what makes this so, so different. Barack Obama never said Islam is a threat. He never had a national security advisor say Islam is a cancer, neither did Bill Clinton. And when you have that as kind of the broader context, the broader stuff around which this ban, from which this ban emerges, I think it explains why there's so much anger about it and so much fear.
And Roulant, to Tony's second point, immigrants who don't speak the language, who are often a financial burden. I mean, there are many, many wonderful immigrants. That's what our country's made of. But speak to that point, to Tony's point, Roulant.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to share that my family immigrated to the U.S. My parents were originally from Syria. My siblings and I were all born and raised in the U.S., and that's just simply factually inaccurate. Statistics show that 14 million doctor's appointments in the United States are provided each year by physicians from these six banned countries. So that statistic alone, I mean, shows that there's a threat to healthcare in the areas that our nation is served by these doctors from those six targeted countries. And that's just one example of the many ways that immigrants have contributed to and benefited the American society.
Let's get Jim in here from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Jim, welcome to the program. Hello.
Thank you. Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Just a quick comment. I was over in northern Greece and Macedonia in September doing medical missions in a Syrian refugee camp, several of them actually. my heart goes out to the refugees, and believe me, with my feet on the ground working with them, there are many people who are suffering. At the same time, in one of the refugee camps that we worked in, there were 6,000 refugees 6 weeks before we arrived. The day we went to that camp, there were 100 people left. I asked the military leader of the camp what had happened to all the people. He said, we just lined them up, asked their names, put them on a piece of paper, gave them a stamp, and we sent them out into Europe wherever they wanted to go. I can tell you that in that situation, there was zero vetting of those people. Now, are all 6,000 of them refugees? Are there some bad people in that group? I think that's the whole point of this ban, and perhaps it's largely political this time around so that the president can claim a victory in his battle with others, the courts, and so on. But the fact is that there are a lot of people that were never vetted, and so I just am concerned that the truth get out and that your guests would, perhaps share some of that and not tell everybody that people waited 18 months of vetting to have.
I got it. I really appreciate your call, Jim. Thank you. Yoki Driesen, jump in here. We've got about a minute and a half left. You hear what Jim said? It goes to John Kelly's point, the Homeland Security Secretary, who yesterday said unregulated, unvetted travel, immigration is not a universal privilege, especially when national security is at stake. Why is that incorrect?
Because the people who come to the U.S. are subjected to between 18 months and 2 years of vetting. I have friends from Iraq, friends from Syria who've been trying to get into this country for 2 years who have worked for the U.S., either for journalists or for the military.
But you heard what Jim said just there.
I did, but it's not correct. I mean, there are people who enter Europe without proper vetting, which is why Europe is facing a massive security problem and massive fear about the refugee influx into Europe. That's also potentially why Europe has had the terror attacks we have not had. But the idea that people are just getting on planes in Baghdad and flying straight to the U.S., it's just not true. That's just not true.
Yoki Driesen, do you think the Trump travel ban 2.0 is going to hold up against inevitable court challenges?
Yes, I do.
Jump in here. Last word, Rula Alush. Where do you see this all going? This travel ban has been signed. Obviously, there probably will be court challenges. What do you hope it does for this country?
I hope that people continue to rise against this bigotry and hate and the discrimination that's coming from this administration and just the wave of hate that feels like it's taken over the country. You know, following the first travel ban, there were many, many people that came out to protest at airports, and hope that people will continue to see the concerns here and rise together to continue to not be complacent and fight against these discriminatory policies.
Rula Alush, chairwoman of the National Board of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Rula, thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Yoki Driesen, deputy managing editor and foreign editor at Vox. Yoki, thanks to you. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jen.
You can continue the podcast, the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.